25 minutes before the top of the hour, you're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290. Drew Mundell, Richard Pollock, Ezra Ginsberg in studio with you until 3 o'clock this afternoon. Illegal Curve Hockey is thrilled to be participating in the Riverview Health Center Foundation Cycle on Life coming up on June the 5th, 2016. Join IC in raising money for the Riverview Health Center's Alzheimer and Dementia Awards by cycling in the event or contributing to Team Illegal Curve. For more information about the Riverview Health Center Foundation Cycle on Life or to join Team IC, visit rhcf.mb.ca or send us a tweet at Illegal Curve and we'll be sure to send you all of the relevant information. Great nights have been few and far between at Rexall Place in Edmonton in the last number of years. I think last night would qualify as one of them, as the Edmonton Oilers organization honored Glenn Sather for his years of work with the team, obviously capturing 5 Stanley Cups as he was in charge of that team, the general manager and, of course, a head coach of that team back in their glory days. I thought the best part of last night was how he entered into the arena to get his ovation. They showed him up in the press box, and then he entered the ice surface by walking down from the press box, walking through the crowd last night, and really sort of basking in the glow of the Edmonton Oilers fans, honoring him for the tremendous job he's done through the Edmonton Oilers until he left the organization in the year 2000.
And to go to the Rangers, who they played last night.
That's right. That's why it was apropos, and the Oilers won the game 7-5.
Which is apropos also,
a high-scoring game, very 1980s NHL last night. You know, what's Glenn Sather's legacy? I mean, obviously he got the 5 Stanley Cups in Edmonton. You know, he hasn't been able to duplicate the same success with the New York Rangers, but among the great architects of NHL teams, I'm thinking Scotty Bowman really comes to mind. You know, where does Glenn Sather sort of rank among the your sort of top 5, top 10 or so of NHL architects in the last, you know, 20, 30, 40 years?
Well, he's right there. I mean, you got 5 Stanley Cups.
Yeah.
And they were arguably the best team of all time. So you're talking Glenn Sather, Sam Pollock, Bill Torrey, some of the greatest general managers and putting the dynasties together that you'll ever see. And changing, you know, obviously the players that he put together changed the way the game was played for more than a decade. I remember the 70s was not a high-scoring era. People don't remember that.
Yeah.
And he came in, and the Oilers team that he put together, and if you read about him and you follow him, which I have, you know, the trust he put in his scouts and the trust he put in the people that he hired and gave him the ability to do what they were going to do, especially, you know, he did that in Edmonton. Like, of course, later in the later years of New York, he really wasn't as present, maybe people thought.
He was general manager more entitled
than
he was.
Well, I mean, not necessarily entitled, Drew, but I mean, he would make the big decisions, but he wouldn't necessarily make all the day-to-day ones. In Edmonton, he would, but he would trust the guys he had around him to do the draft and different things like that. And think about it, certainly has an ego,
sure,
but is still able to trust the people around him, and I think that's so important. And I'm put together, I mean, and the thing was that I thought was so impressive about Glenn Sather was he was able to build up the Oilers to be arguably the greatest team of all time. And then they went to the Cup in 83, they lost. They also made the conference finals years later, even in 90 after, you know, 89 and then 90, very competitive, won in 90 without Gretzky.
Mm-hmm.
Went to the conference finals after that as well. And then he was able to tear it down, basically because he had to, because of the ownership issues.
Mm-hmm.
And then build up a young base, upset Dallas in 97, the first round. Those are some real good teams. Dallas won the Cup in 99, upset the Avalanche in 98 in the first round. That team won the Cup in 96 and 01. I mean, with young teams with very little payroll when there was a huge disparity. So the only real issue with his general managing over the years was the early years of New York until the lockout. And then after the lockout, he adapted especially well, brought in Jágr, bought in Nylander, changed the way that team did business. And they've been as competitive as any team over the past 8, 9, 10 years. So one of the most brilliant managers of all time.
Here's a great quote. Larry Brooks, of course, wrote about it. Larry Brooks covers the Rangers for the New York Post. And here's a quote from, you know, Sather, when it was obvious his time was sort of coming to an end in Edmonton. This is back when the Oilers were owned by a 37-person committee.
Yes, Cal Nichols, the whole crew.
Yeah, Cal Nichols was the chairman of the committee of 37 owners. Quote, here's Glenn Sather. The situation in Edmonton was not something I was prepared to live under. I had bought our longtime head scout, Barry Fraser, a Cartier watch for $3,000, even though it was really a $7,000 watch. It was a gift. You know, it's Barry Fraser had spent 2 decades with the Oilers. One of the owners called me and said, quote, we can't be wasting money on that. The next morning, I called them and told them they could stick the team up their ass. 26, it was actually 37 owners with everybody telling me what to do and how to do it. It was at that point in time he decided he quickly went on to the New York Rangers, not out of work for a blink of an eye as the Rangers scooped him up and his player personnel skills.
He got some good cash over his time with New York, too.
Oh,
apparently
yes,
he was pulling in close to $7 million a year. Yeah. That's a rumor.
And
that's true.
Was there an ownership stake there, too?
I'm not sure if it was, but James Dolan loved Glenn Sather.
Yeah.
And that's not necessarily a good thing if you're Glenn Sather, but, well, it is if you're wanting to keep the job. Not great if you are liked by James Dolan, but
sure.
Anyhow.
You know, Richie mentioned that Glenn Sather should be considered one of the top general managers of all time, and I would throw Lou Lamoriello in there as well. But I think what's almost as impressive is that he was a general manager and coach in
also
Edmonton,
true,
and
yes,
you don't see that anymore. I mean, we saw the late Pat Quinn do that, obviously, with the Vancouver Canucks, but Glenn Sather is so revered around the hockey world, but he was also revered by the players for the type of human being he was. And he was very well liked. And obviously there were times, I imagine, that he rubbed the players the wrong way. And he's always going to be linked to Wayne Gretzky being traded, even though that wasn't his decision. That was really Peter Pocklington's decision. Yeah. We know all that story.
And Sather makes a point, Sather makes a point of saying Gretzky wasn't traded. Gretzky was sold for $15 million.
And you know what? I mean, even though most of his success winning the 5 cups, as you mentioned, Drew, happened in Edmonton, he goes on to the New York Rangers in late 99, 2000, and he just stepped away in favor of Jeff Gorton recently. He's still the president of the team, but
sure,
no longer the day-to-day general manager. But he's had a lot of success in New York as of late. You look at the New York Rangers.
For sure.
They're still at the top of the Eastern Conference. It went to the Stanley Cup Finals a couple of years ago, and they were obviously a competitive team last year, winning the President's Trophy. He doesn't get a lot of credit for what he's done over the last 3 or 4 years with the New York Rangers, right? Let alone how he had those unbelievable teams. I agree with Rich. I think the conversation is early 70s Montreal Canadiens or early 80s Edmonton Oilers, mid-80s Edmonton Oilers. I think those are the two teams you're talking about.
You don't put the Islanders in there?
The Islanders are in there, too.
They won four in a row.
I think the Islanders, even though they won four in a row, are just, I mean, those Oilers teams were way more dominant than those Islanders teams. I mean, you're talking Gretzky and Messier and Curry and these guys. They absolutely tore up the 1980s and really, there weren't any teams. I mean, we remember the Smythe division with the Flames and the Jets.
Yeah.
The Jets couldn't get out of the first round with the Edmonton Oilers and how dominant they were.
Sure.
So not saying that the New York Islanders with Bossy and Gillies and Potvin and all those guys weren't amazing teams, but I just think that the Edmonton Oilers, the way they won and the fact that they even won a year after trading Gretzky was almost as impressive, you know, that year they beat the Boston Bruins in the finals.
And that was him stepping away, John Muckler coaching that team and taking it to finals. But think about it, from 83 to 90, there was an Alberta team in the final every year. So think of just about what you're dealing with in terms of the competitiveness of not Smythe division, as you talked about, Ezzy, but also the Flames.
Sure.
Because the Flames were probably the second best team in the league for most of those years.
Yeah. And they just, I mean, when you play, it's the Central Division all over again.
Yeah, just better.
Just better. I mean, obviously, you're not going to get the same dynasties. I mean, although the Blackhawks are what I would consider a dynasty in this day and age. But, you know, the Flames and the Oilers just battle each other for the real Stanley Cup before you have to go play whoever the victim was going to be out of the Eastern Conference at that point in time.
I thought it was awesome that there were 12 goals last night.
Yeah.
And Glenn Sather's name was raised to the rafters, and you had the high scoring game that we just don't see as much anymore. I thought it was really cool, and the Edmonton Oilers, we talked about them a couple of segments ago. It's really nice to see them win 5 games in a row without Connor McDavid. But I thought it was really fitting for a guy like Glenn Sather because he deserves all the accolades. You know, we've talked about it, the 5 Stanley Cups. I mean, you know, the Olympics maybe were maybe not his best showing with Gretzky there, and you know, we all know what happened there. And but
What, 98? That was Bobby Clark.
Well, later.
World Cup, you mean, 96.
Later.
Which?
Was it 2000? No. I don't know.
Maybe I don't think so. No, Sather has a 96 coach. Remember, they lost to the U.S. and then
that's the World Cup, not the Olympics.
Yeah, they dispatched him for Clark. I think that's what happened, I think. We'll confirm.
Clark was 98 for sure.
Yeah, Clark was 98 and decided Rob Zabner was a good decision.
Well, okay. And then the one other thing I want to talk about, though, is we talk about no trades in the league now.
He made trades.
He made trades, and I know it's easier time. But even he's made trades in this era, big trades. I didn't like the Meandl deal for the Rangers, but I like that he made a trade. Like, he made moves. He made the bold move for St. Louis. Didn't always work, but he made the bold move. But think of all the good trades.
He's picking up Meandl.
Yeah, all the big trades over the years, as you think about it. When they were getting rid of all their players because they had to, got Doug Weight out of New York. Look how good Doug Weight was for the Oilers for so many years. When they stole Roman Hammerlick from the Tampa Bay Lightning, I'm dating myself a bit here. They're getting Yanni Nienema from Philadelphia for Dan McGillis. I mean, he made so many good trades.
Some good trades that you're
Think about it. I mean, then he was able to turn, you can argue whether or not you like the Arnett for Guerin trade, but Arnett was going to get paid. You get Guerin. Guerin was going to get paid. You get Anson Carter. He was able to turn them into guys who were able to contribute. And they had troubles drafting later on in that tenure a little bit and had some struggles. But overall,
Jason Bond Sr.?
Yes, exactly. That's, a guy like that. But overall, they were able to just continue to be competitive, and he was able to identify talent so well. I think that was his biggest strength.
Glenn Sather was the 1996 head coach of Team Canada, along with associate coaches Mark Crawford and Eddie Johnston and Andy Murray as well.
Yeah, he wasn't involved with that 98 team. I thought he was still involved with Clark.
And the reason that he wasn't involved because of the 96. Of Mike Richter is really the only reason he wasn't involved.
Yeah, like, it was Sather's fault that Richter stole the World Cup for the
Brett Hull's high
Edmonton
stick.
Oilers. Exactly. Anyways, let's head to break. When we come back, we are going to, what are we going to do when we come back? We're going to talk about the NHL apparently thinking about renaming the end of season trophies.
Terrible idea.
Well, there's Ezzy's opinion. You'll hear about it next on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. Alongside Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg, I'm your host, Drew Mandel. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets news is IllegalCurve.com. In case you missed it earlier this afternoon, the Winnipeg Jets sending Joel Armia back down to the Manitoba Moose, where presumably he will play for the Moose this weekend. Don't have any confirmation about that, but it seems like a logical move that he would be back in the lineup, get him some game action with the Jets off this weekend and the Moose playing two straight at MTS Center tonight, a game you can hear on TSN 1290, and then again tomorrow afternoon.
Yeah, and they haven't recalled anyone else, Drew. So as you mentioned in the first hour, it's quite possible that Joel Armia is recalled next week, unless the Jets decide that they want to go with someone else. Right now, we're not sure. We're not expecting it to be Nick Petan, for example. But right now, it looks like they'd rather have him playing in the AHL as opposed to in the press box, right? Because Armia hasn't played an NHL game yet.
Mm-hmm. 2017.
This year, he's played.
That's right. 2017 is the 100th anniversary of what we know as the National Hockey League. And in a column in the Sun Media, Mike Zeisberger talks about that the NHL itself is considering changing the name of their current trophies, i.e. the Hart Trophy would change its name and the Norris Trophy would change its name to be more relevant and more sort of recognizable to this era of NHL fan. Your thoughts on the NHL maybe changing the name of the trophies that we've grown up with? That we all know what the Norris and the Hart and the Lady Byng and the Jack Adams and the Selke represent.
You read about these guys and the roles they had early on in the National Hockey League, which I have read before, and it's interesting. You know, it's hard when you're not there to piece together who did what and all that. But as we were talking off air, I like the idea of keeping the continuity of history. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's like, to me, I'm like, like the Vince Lombardi Championship in football, I mean, are we gonna change the name of the Vince Lombardi Trophy and nobody's gonna remember who Vince Lombardi was? And so I like the idea more so instead of changing names and at one or two, okay, I don't like uniform changes on a go forward basis, changing them and then, because what you're doing is setting a precedent to change them all the time, which I don't like. But I would like the idea of, for example, a Wayne Gretzky Trophy for most assists in the league.
So additional.
That is a great idea.
Yeah, like something like that seems to me to be something better. You could give away an award for save percent. You know, whatever it may be to honor the past guys, but you don't need to.
Call it the Connor Hellebuck Trophy.
Very clever there, Ezzy. So so these wouldn't necessarily be, you know, trophies that are voted on. Rather, they're just acknowledgments that, you know, person X has had the most assists, person Y has had the best save percentage, person, you know, J has had the most wins as a goalie in the course of a season.
I agree with Richie, though. I don't think you should make sweeping changes to all trophies, because you're talking about the history of the game here. And sure, Bobby Orr and Wayne Gretzky, you know, Gordie Howe, all these players are part of kind of the last 50 years and the history of hockey. But I think the introduction of the Rocket Richard Trophy for most goals is in the same vein as the Gretzky Trophy for most assists.
Most points for defenseman, Bobby Orr Trophy.
Exactly. So you bring in maybe two or three trophies, and you give those trophies away, and you create history with those new trophies. But changing the Hart Memorial or the James Norris or the Frank Selke, you know, these types of trophies, and I don't know if there's a reason to. Why are we changing the names of those trophies? Are we doing it to commemorate kind of the last 50 years, as I just mentioned?
There's a couple to possibly be changed, but and I can see the point. But yeah, some of those that you mentioned, as you are guys who contributed to the beginning of the league.
Yeah, I don't know what the reason is. I mean, you've brought in, for example, another example, the Mark Messier Leadership Trophy, which Andrew Ladd has been a finalist for.
Mm-hmm.
That's a great idea. Mark Messier is arguably the greatest leader that the game of hockey has ever seen.
My problem with that trophy is just, how do you determine leadership? You know, it's...
Well, I think that would be something that a player vote would be best to determine, or a coaching vote, even the player vote probably.
Yeah. You know what I mean, though, Richie? Like, the point being, as you just said, bring in a Gretzky trophy for most assists. Bring in a Bobby Orr trophy for most points by a defenseman. I actually think that would make the Norris more interesting.
Wouldn't it?
Because I think the Norris is typically given to the defenseman with the most points anyways. Like, no offense to Erik Karlsson. I don't think Erik Karlsson's the best defenseman in the NHL. Yeah. I would say it's Duncan Keith. I think Shea Weber and Drew Doughty. I think these guys are better all-around defensemen, but Karlsson is the best offensive defenseman.
Yeah.
So if you bring in a Bobby Orr trophy for most points by a defenseman, then maybe the Norris trophy gets a little bit more attention to the defensive side of the game, right? So
I think that a lot of the trophies, and I know as a member of the media, I'm probably not allowed to say this, I don't think that the media should necessarily vote on the majority of the trophies. Because I don't think that, you know, the media and, you know, a guy who's covering...
Well, Drew, sorry to cut you off, but it better not be the fans, because if that's the case, they'll give John Scott the Rocket Richard trophy.
No, it wouldn't be the fans. It would be the coaches and the general managers and the players themselves. I think, first of all, acknowledgement from peers who are actually in the game is more significant. And if you're a beat writer who's covering a team for 82 games a year, and you're doing all the tremendous amount of work that's associated with doing that, the travel, the Twitter chats, the online blogs, the everything else, how much time do you really have, if you have a family or want a life as well, how much time do you really have to sit down and watch every game that, you know, another team is playing?
I appreciate that, but the representation is that beat writers from each team vote, so then they represent the 30 teams in the league.
I get that, but I mean, you know, I think acknowledgement from peers...
I don't disagree that some trophies should be voted on in a different manner. Spread it around. Not to the fans.
No, not to the fans. I mean, with all due respect to the fans, that's just a popularity contest.
I don't mind coaches for one, GMs for other, media for a few. I think for a few.
Which I believe is currently how it's done to some degree. Certain media vote on certain awards, and print will do these awards. Broadcasters will do these awards, and general managers will do these. I mean, it's just... I mean, you know, the Alex Ovechkin fiasco from a couple years ago, I think maybe put a stain on everything for a little while at least.
So they voted him in two positions. That was a stain. That's something that needs to be rectified, though. I mean, that was first, second team, all-star team. Who cares about that anyways?
Well, I mean, shouldn't an all-star team, you know, if you're, you know, the best at your position, matter as much as an award? What's the difference? I mean, you know, I'm not, you know, in the NFL, an all-pro... your position is way more than the Pro Bowl. I mean, the Pro Bowl is an all-star game vote, whereas an all-pro means that you've been awarded a
Golden Glove.
But
A Golden Glove. Sure.
Golden Glove is a great honor, right? And did Kevin Pillar win it, by the way? Have they announced that?
I don't think he did.
He didn't. But I mean, the idea is, what's the idea? That all center fielders should win it, or it should be right fielder, left fielder? What if you play both positions? I mean, it's kind of the same idea.
You're the Blue Jays guy. Tell me how Kevin Pillar didn't win the Golden Glove. I mean, he made hundreds of...
Didn't Trout win it in center field?
Trout's pretty good in center field, Drew.
I know. I'm saying that. I mean, Trout. I mean, that's how he. That's how Pilar didn't win it. Was it Trout?
Yeah, Trout's one of the best players in the league.
But is it only center fielders or
no? It's three outfielders, I believe.
I believe, right? So yeah. Same kind of idea.
Same kind of idea. I agree. I mean, I'm just saying that I think it. You know, if you win an award, you know, from the players yourself, your peers and your colleagues, I think it. You know, there's a greater significance to it to some degree. I'm not, you know, I don't really care that much. It's just an idea that you know pops into my mind. In any event, I think
the rare idea that is anything. Next time, skip the segment.
Yeah, thank
I'm
you.
Joking.
Very clever,
you know what, though,
clever.
Drew? It comes back to whether the NHL wants to be hang on to that tradition or start a new tradition. I'm old school in every aspect of my life. I tend to always go back to, you know,
you take horse and buggy everywhere.
No, I don't mean like that. I mean like I respect the history of the game, right?
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that if they change the names of the trophies, it's a lack of respect for the game. I'm just saying those traditions are already there, and I think you should honor those.
Fair enough.
As he goes to the buggy bath and actually washes his buggy.
Yes, his horse and buggy. Exactly right. Let's head to break. When we come back, the St. Louis Blues are the Winnipeg Jets' next opponent on Tuesday night. We'll talk about the Blues with Kelly Chase next on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. Third hour of the Illegal Curve Hockey Show for this Saturday, the 12th of December. 13 more days until Christmas shopping. You guys good on your Christmas shopping so far?
Well, I still have to shop. I still have to get your daughter a present, by the way.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up on air, so you just prevented me from running you over with the bus.
We had the big baby naming about a month ago.
What's a baby?
Yeah, what's a baby naming?
I said baby.
You didn't say baby.
I said baby naming. Anyways, I still have to get Aaron a present.
You do.
And I noticed that, we'll get into that after off air, but I also have to get you and Laura a present, and I have to get Richie. I have to do some shopping.
You better get on it there, Ezzy. You can follow us on Twitter at IllegalCurve, Facebook.com/IllegalCurve.
Richie's
our
getting a lump of coal.
With our latest Winnipeg Jets news is IllegalCurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show hotline.
We are pleased to welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Kelly Chase. Kelly is a radio analyst for the St. Louis Blues. The Blues, of course, will be in Winnipeg on Tuesday night to face the Jets. Kelly, good afternoon, and thanks very much for joining us.
Well, no problem, guys. As long as you can put up with the sticks and the whistles in the background as I watch my kids play hockey, then I don't mind come on all day.
That's, you know what,
that's how we like it, Kelly.
Yeah, you got to have the atmosphere and the hockey background on a hockey show. Otherwise, it's just too sterile.
I'll make sure I keep this away from the crazy parents.
Kelly obviously brought you on to talk about the Blues. They're going to be in Winnipeg on Tuesday night. You know, Blues, you know, sort of trending in the right direction, 16-9-4. You know, everybody in the Central Division is looking up at the Dallas Stars, but, you know, so far so good for the Blues this season? Or you think that there's, you know, only a +2 goal differential? Are there areas of concern that jump out at you at this Blues team so far?
Well, I don't know. I'm not positive of how many it is, but I think they've lost 4 or 5 or 5 or 6. So it's not been very, very good as of late. The emotion hasn't been there a little bit for whatever reason. And I think that, you know, the one thing that I've noticed about the team is that, you know, they talked about how important it was to get out of the gate early, make sure that they were in a position, should they have a little bit of a bump in the road, that they, you know, could sustain teams, you know, that were behind them. And I see, you know, they're slowly creeping down that ladder a little bit, so they want to turn it around. But I think everyone in the league is going through that at some point. You know, the Rangers, who took off so strong, Montreal, same thing. So I think it's not an easy league. Teams get better and go through the ebbs and flows of the season. And, you know, the Blues right now have just got to find a way to try and make sure that they, you know, can correct this thing as fast as possible.
You know, Kelly, you mentioned that the Blues have been struggling a little bit over the last couple of weeks, and they've been obviously dealing with some injuries. Patrick Berglund and Jaden Schwartz come to mind. And one guy that I was really impressed with when they were in Winnipeg, the Blues that is, was Colton Parayko, and he's got 14 points now in 27 games, and he's playing 17 to 18 minutes a night, and he's even getting consideration early on here for the Calder Trophy. How impressed have you been with Colton Parayko?
Well, I've been extremely impressed. We're just talking about it today, you know, like it's one of those things where, you know, the young guys are going to fall off. But if you look at a kid like Parayko, and he's already played a college season, which is just about, you know, which is odd. If you count training camp, what he did at camp, and then you count what he did in Traverse City at the rookie camp, he's played a complete season. So there's a little bit of a fall off for the college kids, and we're seeing that out of them right now. But boy, I'll tell you what a nice problem to have is Colton Parayko there with your team. I mean, he right now is as sound a defenseman as any young defenseman in the league, and I have to believe he's going to get some consideration for the World Cup this summer as well.
You know, Kelly, you look at the strengths of the roster, and one of the strengths is, you know, kind of like Winnipeg, that right side of the back end, you know, with Pietrangelo and with Shattenkirk kind of ahead of Parayko, but really Pareko's played so well. Do you see that maybe changing the organizational direction with a guy like Shattenkirk?
I don't think so. I think, well, Shattenkirk's played like their number one. He's the key to running the power play. He's the key. Everything goes through him on the power play. So if you're going to have success, he's got to be at the top of his game. He generates so much offense for the Blues from the back end, and Petro's a little bit more defensive. He's a very, very intelligent penalty killer. He's extremely good at moving into the tight areas. But when it comes to creating the offense, Kevin Shattenkirk's the engine back there.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. Our guest is St. Louis Blues radio analyst Kelly Chase. Kelly, you look at the goaltending for the Blues, and this has been the question going on for a number of years now about, you know, do they have that number one backstopper to carry the team deep into the playoffs? Jake Allen seems to have sort of taken over the starter's job. He's got 21 games played to Brian Elliott's 12. Have you noticed a difference in Jake Allen, maybe in demeanor or in attitude, which again, or synonym sort of, that tells you he's going to be able to hold on to that job throughout the remainder of the season and into the playoffs?
Well, I think he's been extremely good. He started out of the gate great. He didn't get the wins that he was looking for, but the way his play was, extremely good. So I think what you're seeing now out of Jake is this sense of confidence, too, that he knows he can be a dominant player. To me, that's important, and I think that when you get a young guy that, you know, at first you start off, you want to be good, you want to be a good pro, but you're also kind of glad and learn the ropes and what it's like to play in the NHL. He's beyond that. They put the onus on him to say, listen, you want the starting role? Yeah, you're going to have to earn it. You're going to have to work hard, but we have higher expectations of you, and you should have those same expectations for yourself. And he's taken that serious and taken it to heart, and he's certainly been fantastic this season.
You know, you mentioned Jaden Schwartz earlier, a good Saskatchewan boy like yourself. And I know Richie and I were watching him even when he was playing for Colorado College and NCAA. How much do they miss Jaden Schwartz? And is he still on track to return? When should we see Jaden Schwartz back in the lineup for the Blues?
Well, I think Jaden's still about a month away. But one thing, Berglund's skating a little bit. And obviously he had shoulder surgery, so it's a little different. But you don't really know what you have as a team here in St. Louis. I mean, the trade deadline... maybe Berglund and Schwartz for Doug Armstrong, because we really don't know what we had. You got to remember, you had Stastny out of the lineup for 7 weeks as well. Shattenkirk's been hurt, and also Tarasenko just missed the one. But now you got Steve Ott out of the lineup, who generates so many good things from a conscience standpoint for the St. Louis Blues. So they've been dinged with injuries. Everybody has to go through them. It just seems like St. Louis got hit with some injuries that I think wound a lot of teams where they can't recover. If you think about it, you got Schwartz, Shattenkirk, arguably your number one defenseman. Schwartz, your number two goal scorer. Berglund out of the lineup. You know, it's one of those things where that's a huge blow to a lot of teams. And then, of course, your leader in Ott. So there's been a lot of guys having to step up in certain situations. And Hitch looks at it like he starts the game with 12 players. And he's trying to work it down to 9 by the time the game ends if they're in a tight situation and they play with 3 lines, and that's just kind of how it works.
Yeah, Kelly, when you talk about Paul Stastny there and obviously the injury that you mentioned, having him come back, it was an adjustment for him last year and really, in Colorado too, for Nathan MacKinnon without him. They both seem to kind of struggle without each other. And how he seems to have, he's putting up more points. I haven't seen him play much this year. How has his game changed, if at all, from last season?
I don't think it has. I'll tell you what, the one thing that the Blues are finding is that Dmitry Yastin hasn't had the points that he's had. Schwartz and Tarasenko playing, on a line at different times with different guys. But Yastin was a guy that benefited greatly from a guy like Stastny being on his line. So he was basically a third-line center at times last year because Lotero was playing ahead of him. And I think now you're realizing just how good what a difference Stastny made on a couple of players. Schwartz is another guy that benefited greatly last year. So it took him a while to get comfortable in St. Louis, but definitely, you learn more and more about Paul Stastny and how effective he is from an offensive standpoint.
Kelly Chase is our guest on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Kelly is a radio analyst for the St. Louis Blues. Kelly, Robbie Fabbri has sort of made his NHL debut this season. He started off well, then he had some concussion problems, but he's gone back into the flow of things for the Blues. How has he looked in his first regular action in the NHL?
Well, he's getting better every game. I think he's still more to take. It takes more for him to be a pro. He's going to have to get better. It can't just be good enough to play well. He's got to come up and find ways to score when we need goals. They've put him in a top nine role, and when you're in a top nine role, you're expected to produce, and he's starting to get a little bit more of a feel for that. So you got to remember, he's a 19-year-old kid. He doesn't have his man strength yet. He's kind of, still in a situation where he's a young fella that's going to get bigger and stronger, and he's just not there yet. So he's been good for us. I don't know that it would have benefited him to play junior again this season. So it's good that he's up with the big club, and it's good to see that his game has started to go. It went up for a long time, and then it kind of leveled off and maybe dipped a little, and now he's starting to get a little bit of that second wind.
Kelly, Ken Hitchcock, of course, we know how knowledgeable and how good of a coach he is, but there are some rumblings or reading around the league that it's another year of Hitchcock and it's tough, and then is the team responding, and obviously the recent struggles have brought that to light. How do you see the communication between him and the players? And it is kind of that trial year him and Doug Armstrong are going through here. There's no long-term deal. Do you see this kind of being a make-or-break year for him?
Well, I don't think that, I don't think there's any question that if there was, they didn't have a lot of success, that there's probably going to be a change. But you got to remember, I mean, the guy hasn't coached with a full team all season.
Right.
So, if there wasn't this recent slide of the last five games, he's got to be considered one of the coaches of the year just because based on the injuries. You know what I mean? Who better to get coach of the year than a guy that had this, we were a couple points out of first place until we had this recent dive with the injuries that the Blues have had. It's hard to to really blame the coach. Now, if this continues, this trend, then obviously there's going to be more talk of it because of, the lack of success the last few years in the playoffs. But honestly, you couldn't have asked more of the coach. If you knew you were going to lose the guys we lost and you'd ask them if they'd be satisfied with their record, 7 games over .500 or whatever it is right now, they'd probably taken it. The problem is the success that they had early, the expectations were elevated again, and maybe not the consideration of the fact you don't have your number two goal scorer in Jaden Schwartz, you don't have Patrick Berglund, you don't have a lot of the key matchups hot right now out of the lineup, and it's, those are things that you can use them as excuses, and everybody has them, but it's reality. It's reality that you don't have those players. So I don't think that I'm not sure that Hitch bears the burden of all the blame.
Kelly Chase covers the St. Louis Blues as a radio analyst. Kelly, really appreciate your time this afternoon. We'll let you get back to your kids' hockey game, and we'll see you Tuesday night in Winnipeg for the Blues and the Jets.
He just hit the post, and wouldn't you know it, just like his dad, he didn't go in.
keep those parents in line, Kelly.
Yeah, make sure nobody steps out of line while you're on your watch, okay?
Have a good day.
Thanks, Kelly. It's head to break. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. When we come back, we're going to look at the NHL's free agents that signed in the offseason and how they performed through the first 30 games this year. After the top of the hour, you're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Still to come in about 12 minutes time, Arthur Staple from Newsday will join us. We'll talk Travis Hamonic. We'll talk about the New York Islanders, see if there's been any movement there from Arthur's perspective. In case you missed any of the interviews that have already taken place on the show, they'll be available for download on iTunes, on IllegalCurve.com, and, of course, on TSN1290.ca. This segment brought to you by our friends at Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club, officially declared the funniest place in Winnipeg by Illegal Curve Hockey. For 30 years, Rumors has been bringing Winnipeg the best in stand-up comedy. To purchase tickets or for a list of performers and showtimes, visit RumorsComedyClub.com. Tonight at Rumors, Mike Winfield is in town. 7:45 is sold out. Still a few tickets available for tonight's 10:30 show. And, of course, if you're looking for a New Year's Eve destination, Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club should be at the top of your list. 30 games into the 2015-16 season, it's a fair time to look back at some of the free agent signings that have taken place and see which teams are happy and rejoicing with their decisions and which teams are regretting it. Let's start with Michael Frolik. He's of significant interest to the Winnipeg Jets fans, of course.
Who's that?
Yeah, exactly. Signs in Calgary for $4.3 million per season. He's got he's played 28 games for the Flames, 7 goals, 8 assists, 15 points. Are the Flames happy with that return on investment so far this year?
Isn't that exactly what you expected from him?
Probably.
It was striking to me in the preparation for the show, Drew, you put together a nice little sheet in terms of the production of the players we're going to discuss.
Yeah.
They all kind of seem in line with what you'd expect.
Yeah. When I was doing the same prep, I was like, yeah, okay, that's about right.
Yeah, like Frolik, you know, a point every other game kind of thing. He, a little bit over that pace now, I guess, but a guy who can play different roles in the team, and yeah, that's exactly what he is.
Yeah, Michael Frolik has typically been a 35 to 45 point guy, and he was so with the Winnipeg Jets, mm-hmm. and you expect him to be a versatile player. You can play him on the first line if you want, but on Calgary, maybe not so much, but certainly second and third line. He had the ability to do that in Winnipeg, and he can play penalty kill, he can play power play. He's a great player. I think that the Jets and Michael Frolik were clearly not on the same page when it came to signing a contract, right?
Yeah.
Not just in the sense he signed the wrong contract. Not in the sense that he didn't just sign with the Jets, but I think maybe he wanted to see a little bit more love from the Jets earlier,
right.
Because we know that it wasn't money that made him switch to a Calgary Flame, signing with the Calgary Flames. It was more than that, obviously, right? But they certainly miss him, Drew, I'll tell you that much. I don't necessarily know that they've replaced Michael Frolik as far as all of the things that he's done. But, yeah, as far as offensive production, that's probably where you expect him to be. He'll finish the season around 40, 45 points.
He's reliable, he's played every game for the Flames. Sort of standard operating procedure for Michael Frolik.
Just the kind of guy a coach loves to have because he allows flexibility in the roster.
Yeah. Two players from Colorado, they dip their toe into free agency. The first, Carl Soderberg, formerly of the Boston Bruins, $4.75 million per season. He's given the Avalanche 29 games, 4 goals, 14 assists, and 18 points. And then Francois Beauchemin, $4.5 million per season, 29 games played again, 2 goals, 12 assists, 14 points, and 24 minutes and 2 seconds time on ice per game played.
Yeah, and you look at those offensive totals of guys and you say, okay, well, those aren't that bad, but they did throw a lot of money at Carl Soderberg specifically, and I would say both of those players have been a disappointment. And they're a disappointment because the Colorado Avalanche are last place in the Central Division right now. And those were we should also throw in they acquired Blake Como as well. And, he's had varying degrees of success, but those were their two big acquisitions. And, I think they were expecting Beauchemin to be more of a steadying shutdown influence for the D, Rich. And he's older now, and he certainly hasn't been as good as he was last year for Anaheim. But again, nobody's really been good for Anaheim either this year. But I think when you talk about Carl Soderberg, you're talking about your third line center, 3C, right? And he has the ability, maybe, if you really need him, to be your second-line center. But I don't know if Soderberg impacts the game enough. Like, this Colorado Avalanche team, to me, is kind of similar to the way the Oilers teams have been. They're really skilled, really fast. Defense isn't very good. They need a lot from their goaltender. Varlamov has obviously been better than what the Oilers have had. But it's still, to me, not a very complete team. They don't play, I think, a style that leads to success in the Central Division. I think they rely too much on MacKinnon and Duchesne and Landeskog, the number one line. But certainly it's been a disappointment as far as the team has performed. I mean, individually, 18 points for Soderberg. I mean, you probably expected him to be a 50 or 55-point guy. You didn't expect him to lead the league in points. But 4 goals, that's certainly not lighting the league up by any stretch of the imagination. I mean, Thorbs has got 4 goals.
I mean, there's no real surprise here. Maybe a point, a goal or two more from Soderberg, a couple goals more, sure. But Beauchemin is going to steady with Eric Johnson, and you're getting an older player, but a guy's going to give you a good effort, and he's kind of
slowed down big time.
Yeah,
especially that playoff run. I mean, he hasn't been the same guy.
Does he skate as well as he used to? No. But I mean, I think you knew that when you'd hope that they knew that when they brought him in. Yeah. Both these guys are kind of bringing in what you expect.
You're giving he's a 35-year-old player.
Both of them are bringing in basically what you expect. I mean, your expectations may have been out of whack, but that's not the player's fault.
Antti Niemi in Dallas signed as a goalkeeper, $4.5 million per season. He's 11-4-0-2, save percentage of .909, a goals against average of 2.55.
Well, I think you can't look at that acquisition in a vacuum. You have to look at also how the team has played with Kari Lehtinen, how his effect on Kari Lehtinen has been, the depth of the, you know, the backups that they've had going through town have been pretty bad.
Anders Lind back last year.
And even the, you know, they've obviously locked up a lot of money in there, but you can see what they're trying to do, and then you look at the way they score, and they really just need a certain level of goaltending to be competitive. And overall, again, you know, has he given you any worse or better than what you expected? That's the thing that's striking to me. Yeah, okay. That's about what you thought.
Yeah, Niemi's been good for them, Rich, and the numbers might not be, you know, jaw-dropping, and they're certainly not at the top as far as goalie statistics go, Drew. Mm-hmm. But what he's done is, as Richie mentioned, he's provided competition for Kari Lehtinen and provided a very solid backup, a guy that's won a Stanley Cup, a guy that's been a number one goalie in the NHL. And as Rich mentioned, when you're scoring four or five goals, I mean, Jamie Benn just scored his 20th goal of the year. I mean, this team is scoring four or five goals every night. You just got to be good.
You just need an average goal.
And they open it up a bit. Like, they'll throw their goalie out a bit.
To me, it's going to – I'm looking at the Western Conference, and to me, it's going to be a showdown between Dallas and Chicago. I think those are the two best overall teams in the West right now. I know that necessarily the point totals
don't
reflect that, but I look at that and I say that's going to be the difference, as goaltending is always the difference in the playoffs. And right now, I would take Corey Crawford over Lehtinen or Niemi, but Niemi's done a great job.
Two signings, in San Jose. Paul Martin on the back end gets $4.85 million per year. He's got 7 points in 25 games, 21 minutes and 42 seconds average time on ice. Joel Ward, he gets $3.275 million per season. He's got 10 goals, 12 assists, 22 points in 28 games played.
Well, let me jump in here because I watched Paul Martin for years on New Jersey, and he's been a good defenseman. Richie was a little bit more high on Paul Martin in the acquisition in San Jose. If you watch him play
You know, I can see what they needed to complement the left side and the puck mover, Ezzy, but overall, it was kind of a weird move in the big picture.
Yeah,
and money on a team that seems to be rebuilding, you thought.
And the thing is, he's not as good of a puck mover as he used to be. He's older now. He's in his early 30s. And he's to me, you know, Paul Martin's more of a third-pairing guy on a good team. You want him to probably play 12, 15 minutes. That's just what I see Paul Martin as. And that's why I don't think Pittsburgh was super aggressive on keeping him. I think they saw other alternatives, younger alternatives in the system. But, I mean, certainly for an offensive defenseman, he's had a disappointing start to the year.
I just think you're getting what you thought for the most part. And Ward, you're getting more than you thought.
Yeah, Ward seems like he's been almost giving the best value of a lot of the free agent signings last season.
He's really clicked there. I mean, especially when they didn't have the injuries, clicking with those with Couture and Marleau for a while there. Mm-hmm. But you know, thing about Ward is similar kind of to Frolik in that you can throw him. Now, Frolik kind of plays both wings, but they're both really right wingers. And Ward, you can throw first line, you can throw third line. He can help you in different ways. Real good player.
In Detroit, they gave Mike Green 3 years and $6 million per season. He's responded with one goal, 10 assists, 11 points in 23 games played, and he's averaging 21 minutes and 16 seconds of time on ice per game.
I think it was a great signing, and I think it's pretty good value, Rich.
Yeah.
I don't think you're expecting, I mean, remember a couple of years back, Mike Green, what did he have, 70 points for the Washington Capitals? That's going back, 7 or 8 years now. But last year, he was so effective for the Washington Capitals because he was a third-pairing guy, and Alzner and Carlson and Orpik and Niskanen, those were your top four guys, and he was on that third pair there. If you remember, he was playing with Tim Gleason in the playoffs there.
He's retired now.
That's what he's better suited for, Mike Green. I think, you know, especially he's got some defensive shortcomings, even though he's gotten better defensively.
Still got shortcomings.
He's been able to provide that veteran influence for the Red Wings, because you think about, you know, Jonathan Erickson and Danny DeKeyser, and they've been using Machalenko. I think that's his name. They've got
Marchenko, Marchenko.
Marchenko. They've got some young defensemen there, and I think he's added a nice little offensive element. Maybe he doesn't have the goal totals yet, Rich, but he can certainly move the puck still.
Yeah. The injuries for a bit, and now he's back at it. And basically, what you thought, right?
Mm-hmm.
Adds in a right side element to their back end, and an offensive guy, play on the power play, move the puck real well, and that's what they're looking for. Ken Holland's been looking for that player for a while. That's why they brought in Zielicki last year. That kind of a role, just Green's better than them.
I sort of miss the era where NHL GMs made asinine moves that leave you scratching your head, because it was very logical moves last season for the most part.
Well, if you want one of those, look at the Alex Semin contract, even though it was only a one-year, $1 million contract.
No, that's not asinine, though. I mean, you take a flyer on a guy for $1 million. It only costs you money. I mean, asinine is giving him 7 years like they did a couple years back.
There you go.
Matt Beleski in Boston, $3.8 million per year, 3 goals, 11 assists, 14 points in 25 games played.
He's been a huge disappointment. I mean,
really? Like, what did you expect?
Well, I mean, you're talking about a guy who had 20-plus goals last year. Sure, he might have been playing with Getzlaff and Perry for part of that in Anaheim, Rich, but they were expecting a lot more out of Bielski, I think. I'm not saying they expected 40 goals out of Matt Bielski, but 3 goals in 29 games. I think they were expecting a little bit more. So I would say that was a disappointment. Even depends what your expectations are, because for a guy like Bielski, Rich, he was a third liner for the Ducks up until the last few years, and he was a guy who kind of evolved a little bit later. People forget, you know, he's in his mid-20s. He's not like as young as some people think he is. But I don't know. That Boston Bruins team, even though they're competitive right now, I think they're still struggling to score goals.
I don't, you know, Bielski's exactly, sure, a few less goals to Ezzie's point, but overall point total, I thought, is basically what you expect.
Last one, Justin.
And that's not very good.
Well, hey, that's they should have known that going in.
Yeah. Last one, Justin Williams in Washington, $3.25 million per season. He's responded with 18 points in 27 games played. This seems like a guy who's fit in well with the Washington Capitals.
Well, kind of fits in well everywhere, doesn't he? Yeah. Goes to Carolina, they win, fit in well in Philly before Carolina, fit in L.A., won 2 cups. And what does he have, 3 cups?
Yeah,
or
sure.
Is he not? Yeah, 3 cups, right?
Carolina,
2 in L.A. and,
2
and
in
one
LA.
In Carolina.
Yeah.
And the guy's a winner. And he's going to go to Washington, and he went to Washington, of course, and he's contributing on their, you know, playing with Kuznetsov a lot, who's an exceptionally talented player. He does the dirty work, and he's still moving pretty well. It surprised me kind of the way he's moving here in Winnipeg. So, I mean, that contract was one of my favorite of the offseason. I didn't really see the downside.
Yeah, Justin Williams has been great. We talked about it. Williams, Oshie,
yeah,
on the right wing. You add skilled, talented players, kind of more veteran players, especially Williams is quite a bit older than Oshie. But Oshie's in, 26, 27 now at this point in his career. So I think they've both been really good. And as Rich mentioned, Williams has got the 3 cups, and Ovechkin's still looking for number one.
Let's head to break. When we come back, Arthur Staple from Newsday Newspaper is going to join us. We'll talk a little bit about Travis Hamonic and the New York Islanders. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. I'm your host, Drew Mandel, alongside my colleagues, Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg. Follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets news is illegalcurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
We are pleased to welcome back to the program our very good friend from Newsday Newspaper in Long Island. He covers the New York Islanders. Arthur Staple, good afternoon and welcome back to the program.
Good to be back with you guys.
You likewise, Arthur. It's always good to hear from you. Has Travis Hamonic been traded to the Winnipeg Jets yet?
No, I don't think so. It's pretty funny that since this pretty big bombshell came out, really nothing has changed other than the fact the Islanders have continued to play pretty well to start this season, and Travis Hamonic has continued to be a big part of it. So, yeah, it's kind of a holding pattern, and it seems like it's going to be that way for a while.
Yeah, to your point about it being a holding pattern, and it, you know, Hamonic obviously made the request and it became public, but he doesn't seem like it's really affected him in terms of on-ice performance since it's become so public and really talked about all over the NHL, because nobody ever gets traded. So the thought that somebody might get traded makes waves throughout all 30 NHL cities.
Yeah, you know, it certainly didn't affect his play when none of us on the media side knew about it for the first 6 weeks of the season. He was by far their best defenseman and most consistent defenseman during that time, and the Islanders were not playing particularly well. I mean, their defense was pretty good, but they were having some deficiencies on offense and not generating a lot of offense from their defense. Since it went public, I had a feeling that Garth Snow had worked very hard and Travis Hamonic's agents had worked very hard to keep it quiet, and a lot of the other GMs around the league had worked hard to keep it quiet. And then when it came out and all the speculation was around, I thought there was maybe a slightly increased chance over the following week or two that something might happen. A team might decide to jump at what Garth Snow was asking for. But it didn't happen, and I think, Travis Hamonic was certainly made aware by Garth Snow when they had their conversation that it might not happen during the season this year. And it certainly looks like now that the Islanders are hitting a groove that there's really no reason for them to make this move unless somebody really blows them away with an offer.
Arthur, how did it become public? Is that something that came out, you think, through the agent?
I don't know for sure. I don't believe it was the agent's you know, Kevin Epp and Jarrett Bousquet are, you know, they work for Travis, and Travis definitely wanted to keep this quiet. You know, I think you could tell the one time that he spoke publicly about it, he was not terribly comfortable speaking about this. And he is a guy who has, you know, opened up a lot of his personal history for people to talk about and to the media in the past. So, you know, I think the agents have been respectful of that process. I think a lot of the GMs have, you know. I don't really know if the Islanders know who did it, but I can certainly tell you this, that Garth Snow is not the kind of guy who likes to, you know, have things revealed that he doesn't want revealed. So if they know which team or some, wherever it came from, that if it was another team that did leak it in some ways, or maybe to kind of push the process along, I can pretty much guarantee that Travis Hamonic isn't going there. So, you know, if that was the Jets, good luck to the Jets trying to make this happen, because there's, and I wouldn't call it vindictiveness, I would just call it, you know, justice. Garth Snow is a big believer in you know, justice, and he wants to make sure that, that the process, you know, goes the way that he wants it to go.
Arthur, you mentioned that the Garth Snow has clearly been trying to accommodate Travis Hamonic and trade him, and we hear that it's a collection of teams that he wants to go to for obvious family reasons, but is there still a chance that Travis Hamonic is a member of the New York Islanders as the trade deadline passes?
Oh, I, you know, to me right now, that's the most likely scenario. I just don't see a situation where, you know, I imagine that the amount of weeks that that Garth Snow has been working on this, and, you know, the conversations he's had, whether it's with Kevin Cheveldayoff, whether it's with Peter Chiarelli or, you know, Brad Treleving, you know, those seem to be the three most likely spots. And, you know, I think the Islanders have certain guys that they in mind that they would want back, whether it's a one-for-one deal or a multiple-player deal. And I don't think either of those three teams is willing to give up the guys that the Islanders are interested in. So, you know, I think unless somebody decides to break that stalemate between now and the end of February, yeah, I think Travis Hamonic is an Islander through the end of the season and through the postseason, however long they get, and then, you know, over the summer when teams kind of reassess and maybe you're a little bit more willing to move some big pieces around, maybe it gets revisited then. But for now, I don't really see a way other than someone meeting, like I said, meeting Garth Snow's asking price, that this necessarily happens.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. Our guest is Arthur Staple of Newsday Newspaper. He covers the New York Islanders. Arthur, I mean, Garth Snow, underrated in our minds as a general manager, but he's got a really busy offseason ahead of him. In addition to the Hamonic story, he's got a number of unrestricted free agents that need new contracts, ranging from the, you know, key members of the squad, Kyle Okposo, Franz Nielsen, and, you know, a little bit lesser known but still effective, of Matt Martin. How is it coming? You know, how's he doing in trying to get any of these guys under contract?
You know, I don't necessarily think that there's been a ton of movement. You know, Franz Nielsen has been an Islander the longest of anyone with this crew, and you know, he re-upped on a 4-year deal, you know, 4 seasons ago at a pretty reasonable $2.75 million. You know, for a guy who does what he does, it's obviously a huge bargain. I'm not necessarily sure that Franz Nielsen is looking to give more hometown discounts this time around, but I don't think that there's a lot of dispute about what his role is on this team and how he fills it. If he's a, whether he's a second line center or a third line center, whether he does a lot of penalty killing, power play, he's really the only guy who plays, the only forward who plays in all three situations, and he's pretty essential to what the Islanders do. So if there's a deal to be made there, I imagine those two sides will come together pretty quickly, whether it's during the season or later, and, you know, after the season's over. Matt Martin, probably the most popular Islander inside the room and outside the room, if you combine the two. He's a, you know, he's a guy who represents the team probably the most of anybody in the community around here. You know, he's just a very popular guy. His skills maybe are not at the same level as some of the other, you know, big name forwards on the team, but I think he fills a pretty essential role to them, and you know, does, gives them what he can. Obviously, leading the league in hits the last few years, that says something, and I think that has some appeal to this team. And I don't think that's going to be a huge negotiation or something that's going to be a big fight over money or term there either. You know, obviously Kyle Okposo is the guy that the spotlight would be on. He's a very important person in the team as well, and one of their leading scorers. name is mentioned a bit in trade rumors over the summer right before the draft, and I think that took him a little bit by surprise, and may also have been a little bit surprised that his agent, Pat Brisson, and Garth Snow had, you know, very, very brief and unfulfilling conversations about a possible extension. So, again, I think similar to Hamick, I don't think Kyle Pozo is going anywhere by the trade deadline unless this team suddenly does a, you know, a reverse and starts sliding down the standings. But I don't see Kyle Pozo being here beyond free agency period next summer. And I think this is a situation where he's giving it all he has because he knows he wants to get a new contract, and the Islanders are going to take what he gives them through the end of this year, and then maybe if it's a hugely successful run in the spring, things might change. But as of right now, you know, I think they're just, you know, both going to be happy with the situation they have right now for this season, and think about it as July 1 gets closer. And I don't necessarily see him being an Islander beyond then.
No, Arthur, getting away from the players on the ice for a second, I remember last time we had you on, we were talking about the move from Long mm-hmm. Island to Brooklyn, but we haven't had you on in a while, so we've been about 30 games into the season now. But how has the team responded to the move from Long Island to Brooklyn, and especially the fans? Because I know that was pretty tough for some fans, especially ones that lived in Long Island, to see the team move to Brooklyn. But how's that transition been for the team early on this season?
It's been a slow process. It was not a move that was met with universal good feelings. Obviously, this is a team that played in the same building, a building that didn't change very much for 43 years. It really became part of the fabric of this, you know, major suburban area out in Long Island, and really, you know, the only professional team out there, and something that the fan base that kind of dwindled a little bit during the dark years in the last couple of decades, but a very fiercely loyal small group of fans. And I think a lot of them, especially the ones who live further out east on Long Island, it's very difficult to get to the games and kind of make the adjustment to being in a new building. And that alone, having to ride the train for an hour each way rather than drive 15 or 20 minutes has probably turned away a few fans that used to go a lot. And then there's the specs of the building that are just, it's just a building that's not, was never really meant to hold a hockey rink. And it frustrates a lot of people. I certainly hear a lot about it on Twitter from the frustrations of some of the fans when they come in the building and, you know, one end of it looks a little barren and dark, and there's a, you know, a giant car down in the corner in one end, and it looks funny, and it takes a lot of getting used to. And I think the players, you know, players are players. They maybe don't like change in routine, but they're certainly adapted. It's probably an odd sight for commuters taking the Long Island Railroad into New York City to have half the Islanders team in the car with them on the way in the morning, but. You know, I think for some of the guys, it's just another thing to get used to, as well as the day hotel rooms in Brooklyn rather than being in their own bed for their daytime naps. It's hasn't obviously affected their play on the ice very much. They've been pretty good at home, and despite the smaller crowds and the odd shaped building, so I think they're making it their own and slowly adapting to it. The fans are a little bit slower to adapt, but I've also heard from a lot of fans who love it, who just love having a new facility to be in with great food options and a nice, vibrant area right around it in Brooklyn, which is, you know, one of the fastest growing areas of the Northeast. So I'd say it's a mixed bag right now for everyone, whether it's players, fans, and, the results on the ice will tell towards the end of the year how everyone will feel about it. If they're able to play deep into the playoffs, nobody will really notice that much all the negatives about it.
What's up, Arthur, with ownership? Is Charles Wang going to keep his interest in the team? Is that going to be slowly sold off? Is that what we're hearing? And what's the next step there?
Scott Malkin and John Ledecky take over the majority share, which I believe is 85% of the franchise, on July 1. So this is Charles Wang's last year as the majority owner, and he wanted to see this move through, and he really hasn't been terribly visible, kind of like he was in the last few years. But he's still in charge, and Garth Snow is his guy, and we'll see what happens on July 1. Although, you have to say, you know, Garcinoe's been in charge for a decade now, and Jack Capuano is one of the longest tenured coaches mm-hmm. now in the league. And, you know, you don't see a lot of coach general manager changes that deep into the summer. So I think a lot of people who might be waiting to see what happens with the Islanders front office when the new owners take over might have to wait a little bit longer. But yeah, they take over the first day of free agency, and, you know, we'll see what happens, if anything happens in terms of the change then. But, you know, there's a lot of hockey left to be played between now and then, and I think Charles Long wants to go out finally, having seen his team win a playoff series and hopefully a little bit more than that.
Arthur, we'll let you go on this last question then. You know, you talk about, you know, the ownership and, you know, the long-tenured relationship of Garth Snow and Jack Capuano. Is there extra pressure on these guys to, you know, have a longer playoff run with a new ownership group coming in, or do you think that they're fairly stable as long as they have good, you know, regular season performance this year and are indeed a playoff team, as most people expect?
No, I would think there's a little bit more pressure. You know, the new owners have been around, and I think there's relationships there, and the transition, I don't think they want it to be quite so harsh. You know, maybe if the team were where it was 4 or 5 seasons ago, things might be a little bit different. But this is a good team, and I think that's, you know, there's definitely some appeal to the continuity part of it. You look at what's happening in Pittsburgh again. You know, there's some teams that are right around the Islanders that have made a lot of changes and really don't have about as much to show for it as the Islanders have in the last few years. That's not to say that changes wouldn't necessarily be something that would work well for the Islanders, but they've chosen the continuity route, and I think they feel like they've improved a lot as a result with the same voices being heard. So, you know, we'll see what happens with the ownership changes. Obviously, the big change to move to Brooklyn was kind of a rocky situation. But for now, I think those guys are in charge. I think to my mind, they've got to win a playoff round this spring to show that they've, you know, completely exercised the ghosts of the last, whatever it's been, 22 seasons now that they haven't won a playoff round. So I think that's really the main goal this year, and obviously to go as deep as they possibly can. And if it doesn't happen, then we'll see what happens in the spring. But if it does happen, I would imagine that both guys would be back at least to start the season, that the new owners wouldn't want to make such drastic changes with a team that was headed in the right direction.
Arthur Staple covers the New York Islanders for Newsday Newspaper. Arthur, always appreciate your time this afternoon. Thanks very much for joining us on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
Thank you, too, guys. Anytime.
Thanks, Arthur. Let's head to break. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290. As he does each and every Saturday afternoon, Bruce Springsteen leads off the final segment of this Saturday's Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
Great job by Chris today.
Of course, always a great job by Chris manning the board, which would theoretically be behind the glass, but is actually in the same room as us. But that's still good. Chris does a fantastic job. Let's finish it off with one final segment. You know it, you love it. It's Rapid Fire.
Rapid Fire.
We start with Alex Semin. The Montreal Canadiens terminated his contract earlier this week. Is this the last we see of Alex Semin in the NHL?
Yeah, nobody should be shocked by this.
No.
Alex Semin was absolutely horrible for the Carolina Hurricanes. That's why they bought him out. He wasn't very good in his last few years in Washington, really, either, Richie. So we shouldn't be surprised by this, and I wouldn't expect him to be back in the NHL, certainly anytime soon.
Yeah.
Concur, Richard?
See you later, man.
See you later.
It's been a good run.
In an op-ed on both ESPN and TSN.ca, Pierre LeBrun comes away with the thesis that he believes that if you engage in a fight in the NHL, it should result in an automatic game misconduct.
No.
Okay, well, there's Izzy's answer then. You don't think it should be an automatic game misconduct?
No. I mean, you spend 5 minutes in the penalty box. It's been that way for a long time. I mean, I guess obviously you're trying to discourage fighting by doing that. And I think fighting is already down. I mean, you've seen the Jets get into a few fights. You saw Mark Stewart get into a fight the other night. And you saw Jacob Trouba fight Michael Latta on the Washington Capitals. So, no, I don't think that's a good idea.
Yeah, I've said it before. I'm in favor of keeping fighting in the game. I just don't see the need for the enforcer who doesn't really contribute much. He needs to be kind of a needs to be an organic thing. You talk about the Michael Latta, Jacob Trouba thing. That's an organic thing. Latta plays fourth line center. Trouba is a big part of the Jets team. They drop the gloves in the heat of the moment. Yeah. None of that contrived stuff. I have no time for
that. And by the way, Gregory Campbell got the instigator
Mark
Stewart, and he got the misconduct because he was chirping a little bit after that.
Well, no, that's a misconduct is automatic from the instigator.
Yeah.
Right, but I mean, the point being that he got the instigator, the extra two, because he initiated that fight after Mark Stewart hit, I forget who it was, if it was Burakovsky on Columbus, I think it was Wenberg, actually. I forget who it was that Stewart hit, and then that precipitated the fight. Campbell came over, but...
Don't you find that, though, many games where we've seen a lot of instigators and they don't get called?
Yes.
Then they call that one, which was the right call. It was an instigator. Yeah. But how many times has it happened this year? Three or four times where... It's clearly instigator, and they just don't call it.
No.
It's a weird enforcement policy by the NHL officials. Dan Hamhuis took a vicious slap shot to the jaw, his face shattered, blood everywhere. How significant? He's going to be out of the Canucks lineup for weeks on end. How significant of a loss is it to this Vancouver defense?
Well, significant loss because he is your steadying force on the back end, and you have some young guys there that they've been trying to work in. And, you know, Drew, they're not the deepest team. They're not the deepest team up front or the deepest team on the back end. So when you lose one of your top guys, I mean, that's a hard, you know, it's just simple, but I think a true statement. He's a lockdown. It's kind of like your steadiest guy. I mean, he's not your most highly skilled defenseman, but he does everything pretty well. He skates pretty well, moves the puck out of his own zone pretty well, makes a smart play. They can rely on him. And when you lose a guy like that, it's a huge loss.
Yeah, and Chris Tanev and Alex Edler, and, you know, they've still got some good defensemen there. And they lost Kevin Bieksa, of course, over the offseason to the Anaheim Ducks.
I mean, that's addition by subtraction
there. It's a work in progress, this Vancouver Canucks team. So certainly they're going to miss Dan Hamhuis. I mean, you're talking about a guy who was on the Canadian Olympic team. He's an excellent defensive defenseman. But again, the Vancouver Canucks, I think their biggest problem right now, and they've got a lot of young players in the lineup, a lot of rookies. I think they've gone through something like six rookies. We talked about that when the Jets played the Canucks earlier this season with Ben Kuzma. To me, it's still a team that's going to be scratching and clawing to get back into the playoffs because you're talking about a team that's going to be competing with the Sharks and the Flames. This Canucks team, to me, is still going to be in tough to make the playoffs again.
That's an interesting thing to me. I mean, if you're the Canucks, you have to don't look at the division and try and take advantage of it. Look at the overall long term. You have McCann, you have Vertanen. Right, you have Horvat, a young player. You have Brock Besser. You have these guys coming through the system. Mm-hmm. You have Shinkarak. A lot of these guys, many of them haven't seen play. Lots of them I have. And you look at them, you say, okay, this is a team that's building with young players for the long haul. Don't let the fact you're in a terrible division skew your long-term goal.
Acknowledge what you are, even though you play in a bad division. Yeah. That's it for this Saturday afternoon in the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290. Big thank you to our guest, John Forslund, Carolina Hurricanes broadcaster. Keener from Keener Jerseys talking about NHL jerseys. Kelly Chase, St. Louis Blues analyst, and Arthur Staple of Newsday. In case you missed any of the program, it's available for download on iTunes, on tsn1290.ca, and on our website, illegalcurve.com. Big thanks to our sponsors, Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club, Linden Market Dental Center, Bernstein's Deli, Zappia Group Realty, the Riverview Health Center Foundation, Cycle on Life, and Keener Jerseys. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/IllegalCurve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets news is IllegalCurve.com. For producer Chris, for Richard Pollock, for Ezra Ginsberg, I'm your host, Drew Mindell. If it's Saturday, it's the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290.